Hello, hello, and welcome back to the forum where science comes to socialize. This is Cleo, and I have Aubrey and Daniela here with me here as usual.
Hey guys, it's Daniela, and we've got another food-related episode lined up for you, which you know by now is my favorite forum topic, so I'm definitely happy that you're listening in today.
Hey guys, I'm Aubrey, but before we get into the specifics about today's topic, remember that you can find us at ISGP Forum on Twitter and ISGP's The Forum on both Facebook and SoundCloud. We're more than happy to chat with you about any questions or ideas you may have regarding today's episode, or, any of our other 60-something episodes at this point.
Okay, so today we will be tackling the debate that featured Dr. Wendy Wolford, who at Cornell University is the Robert A. and Ruth E. Paulson Professor of Development Sociology and the Faculty Director of Economic Development in the Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, which is quite the title. The conference at which this debate took place was in the ISGP's Food Safety, Security, and Defense series, and this particular program was focused on food and the environment. The conference took place in October of 2014 at Cornell, which I might add was quite beautiful in the fall.
Yeah, you're not kidding. I took very many pictures, but that's not surprising for anyone who knows me. But anyway, when we weren't hiking in the hills of Ithaca, we were actually debating. Fancy that. Dr. Wolford's paper specifically was titled Competing for Land: Future Trajectories for Rural Development, and it can be found under the Publications tab at scienceforglobalpolicy.org. All right, so I get that this paper title probably doesn't really sound food related at first, but we promise it's a really important and seemingly under-discussed piece of the global food system and security conversation, aka right up our alley here on the forum.
Right. So Dr. Wolford begins by posing the idea that, quote, the question of how to feed a growing global population without further compromising global resources has become perhaps the single most pressing issue of the 21st century, end quote. So some pretty high stakes here, people.
For sure. So she then suggests that this sort of wake-up call to food insecurity that we've experienced in the first decade or so of the 21st century has led to what she's calling a global land grab. This essentially sums up to a procuring of rural land by both private and public investors in order to secure space for the production of flex crops, which, by the way, are crops that can be used for multiple purposes. Like how soy and corn have uses spanning food, fuel, and industry.
So they're basically like the triple threat of the food system.
Yes, they're like Selena Gomez's of food, or Hugh Jackman, or Jennifer Lopez, or JT.
Or Shohei Ohtani, if you're more of a sports person like me and we're following last year's MLB offseason.
Yeah, totally. So securing
Don't
land.
pretend you know what I'm talking about.
Securing land for growing food sounds like a pretty good idea, considering a lot of the prevailing research leads scientists to believe that we need to double our food production by 2050 in order to feed our growing human population. However, there are some significant concerns over these new large-scale land acquisitions, which we can call LSLA for short, because you know how we love our acronyms here on the forum.
So first, let's kind of set the stage here. Just over 10 years ago now, the year 2007 was historic because 1 billion people were characterized as food insecure, meaning 1 billion people were chronically waking up and going to bed hungry. While this number has now dropped to around 815 million, that is still a seriously large number of people. Basically, high oscillating food prices and widespread food insecurity have become the new normal for our world.
Along with protests and unrest, including anti-government riots in more than 60 countries, this insecurity has given way to a rush for land. According to Dr. Walford, quote, public and private investors have acquired large tracts of land for the purposes of increasing food and fuel production, end quote. From 2008 to 2009, conservative estimates suggested that the amount of land changing hands increased between 15 and 20-fold over the annual average for the preceding 40 years, which is an insanely huge amount. And because about two-thirds of the recent LSLAs are located in Africa, this recent phenomenon has also been dubbed the New Scramble for Africa.
Dr. Walford summarizes some concerns in regards to these large-scale land acquisitions, including the tendency of these deals to mainly benefit the often foreign investors as opposed to local communities. LSLAs can also displace small farmers, threaten local ecological integrity, and even reduce local food production.
Because of these negative consequences, LSLA has some definitive opponents who instead support small-scale agroecological farming methods in communities. While these two ideas don't necessarily have to be oppositional, what is clear is that we need multidimensional responses to low land productivity, to poverty, to ecological fragility, and rural urban development.
Okay, so now let's get into what the debaters had to say about this topic. To start, land tenure is at the heart of agricultural transformation, as well as structural transformation of an economy. This duality makes the concept of land tenure part of a complex set of issues underlying rural development.
And just so we're all on the same page here, land tenure can basically be described as who or what owns the rights to a certain piece of land. But of course, it's not quite that easy, since understanding land tenure requires that the value of the land area itself be separated from the value of the land's functionality.
Land tenure is usually pretty narrowly conceptualized as land governance or land administration. But right now, we're sort of in need of a more discerning definition that encompasses the norms of land access and use in a particular locale. Since different countries have different traditions of land ownership, it is particularly challenging to identify a universally accepted definition of land tenure.
Not to mention, this gets even more complicated in regions like Africa, where land rights were traditionally held by tribes, but where many countries were formed without consideration of these tribal territories.
And without an adequate definition, it's very difficult to implement adequate, or really any, policy initiatives. A lot of these land tenure issues are taking place in sub-Saharan Africa, where there's serious interest by outside investors in acquiring rural land. And maybe you can start seeing how this situation starts becoming particularly tricky.
While these investors promise to respect, quote, voluntary guidelines concerning land use and tenure, a system that outlines these guidelines within the context of specific countries or locales doesn't actually exist. What makes things worse is that the binding legal right of investors to their acquired land is also not always clear. Unfortunately, in most cases, the governments of the countries offering these land acquisitions are not yet equipped to facilitate and oversee these transactions, leaving a lot of room for, let's just call it, shady behavior.
Right. Investors, usually larger companies, are generally reluctant to disclose how much land they have acquired and the terms that were used in the acquisition, making it even more difficult to define LSLA. Thus, the amount of land acquired by these outside investors is currently unknown in many developing countries.
Bet all you listeners out there didn't think that land before food was even planted in it could be so complicated, huh?
Yeah, I'll be honest, I definitely forgot it was this convoluted.
Well, you guys may want to hold off on those comments because the issue goes a bit deeper. Currently, very little actual governmental oversight exists that's dedicated to monitoring land acquisitions and ensuring that the agreements are transparent. Data on this, like who has been awarded what land and where and under what conditions the transaction is made, is seldom made public.
Many of these land deals are negotiated covertly and, unfortunately, often to the detriment of local small landholders. Because of this, the debaters discussed whether or not the land acquired by these foreign investors should be returned to native residents, which was a conversation that surely did not provide a straightforward answer at our conference.
Adding to their confusion was the question of how binding and how legal land acquisitions are in different parts of the world and from country to country. And that may sound strange to people in places like the US or UK, but for more underdeveloped regions, this can be the typical case scenario.
For example, in some African countries, local governments don't have the capacity to insure investors with a legally binding document proving ownership of the land. The debaters didn't exactly reach a conclusion on where this leaves us or how exactly we should deal with this predicament.
Which basically means this is the perfect opportunity for our listeners to weigh in with any suggestions on how to untangle this land mess.
We would definitely love to hear your thoughts on these gray areas. We do know, however, that the land in question is typically being acquired by large companies, investment groups, and other countries, and that each of these groups' purposes and intentions with the land is different. For instance, countries such as China, India, and Qatar are acquiring land for future production of food.
And that's not even considering the past 4 years where China has dramatically increased its investments in Africa.
All right, and then private companies are acquiring land for commodity crops such as soy and palm oil.
While investment groups are using land as a hedge against inflation. In contrast, though, the governments of South Africa and Zimbabwe have made their own land grabs and then redistributed what they acquired to native residents for small-scale farming.
Well, how kind of them.
Well, totally. It's just that there's still the issue of training for rural farmers, which these governments didn't provide along with the land grab. So this gap in knowledge and support kind of increases the odds for failure within such a nice endeavor. But the concept's there to keep the land in the family, so to speak.
It's also important to note that while acquiring land for food production is important, about two-thirds of all documented land acquisitions are speculative rather than actively intended for agricultural production. These speculative LSLAs do not produce regionally edible foods required to combat global food insecurity. Instead, this land is often used for the production of large-scale exported commodities like soy, palm oil, or biofuels.
You know, something else we haven't mentioned yet in this conversation that's super important anytime we're talking about agriculture and the food system?
The amount of cheese and bread it takes for me to feel food secure?
Not where I was going, but I totally feel you on that one.
Well, since I'm not a crazy person, I was thinking water, maybe?
I guess that probably would have been a more appropriate answer.
Yes, so water. The debaters spent some time talking about the issue of water. In most of the less affluent world, water is more scarce than land, and it's becoming scarcer at a rapid rate. Since these LSLAs are happening primarily in sub-Saharan Africa, it's important to remember that a significant portion of this area is landlocked and heavily reliant on groundwater. This poses a problem for communities that aren't able to identify sustainable sources of water for agricultural production.
This is really reminding me of an article that I saw recently about Cape Town actually coming up on the end of its water supply. But I don't want to get off topic, it just seems relevant. So there's definitely a concern here regarding the issue of water rights, especially where land investments make it essential to acquire water for the purposes of agriculture.
Okay, so that definitely seems like something investors need to figure out if they're acquiring foreign land.
And something that governments, or at least locals, need to figure out for their own consumption.
And another thing we do need to consider, something that's often actually overlooked, is the recognition that smallholder agriculture is not always the goal of native rural communities, whether they have the land and water for it or not.
Totally. Just because we in the Western world kind of tend to romanticize small-scale farming, that doesn't mean it's the right or preferred form of development for others. Increasingly, younger generations and their parents in the non-Western world recognize education as a pathway to higher-paying jobs, ones that offer more future choices than just farming.
In many parts of the world, rural people are moving to urban areas, not because they want to quit farming necessarily, but because agricultural careers generally are less rewarding monetarily. Conversations about smallholder agriculture facilitated by outside interests must take these local realities into account and be sure not to prejudge the most appropriate development path for any country.
Interactions with these countries and small-scale farmers must also include education, as well as discussions about how this education can be provided for farm families with little or no access to schools. The debater suggested that advances in information technology in rural parts of the world could lead to improvements in education.
And since rural areas all over the world are increasingly populated by cell phone towers, a serious effort has emerged to provide information to farmers by cell phone. Thus, an opportunity exists to adopt this technology to provide education, spanning beyond farming, for children as well as adults.
So something that reminds me of education and that's sort of unavoidable in any food conversation is the topic of plant breeding.
Definitely unavoidable, and one of my favorites. But how exactly does it fit in with land acquisition?
Okay, well, it's not totally a seamless connection, but the debaters did talk about it for a while. You see, how someone is breeding plants and what plants they're actually breeding is connected to and somewhat dependent on land tenure, or who owns the land. Plant breeding is primarily controlled by the private sector, and the private sector primarily invests in no more than four or five large commodity crops.
Okay, I think I see now. So this would kind of run up against the whole growth and promotion of local and regional small-scale food production then.
Right. And while private investment in agricultural research is growing, public investment has declined in the past 20 to 25 years. These private companies that hold the majority of the market just don't have the incentives to conduct research on the less widely planted crops, things like pigeon pea, sorghum, and millet, many of which are grown by smallholder farmers.
So there's a huge need to continue bioengineering these non-commodity food crops, especially because doing so improves disease resistance and yield production, and therefore improves regional food security.
So then, if this is the case, I'm going to take it a step further and guess that there's a need for governments to invest in site-specific plant breeding research focused on developing plants that would improve agricultural success for smallholders.
For sure, and there's also a need to balance between public and private research recruiting for plant breeders, so that there's diversity in knowledge and research background for these more regional, less commodity-driven crops.
While we're talking about next steps and potential solutions here, I'm going to throw in the idea that there's a need for responsible oversight by governments that's focused on monitoring, publishing, and then making transparent these land acquisition arrangements. You know, since that seems to be the starting point for all the challenges we've talked about today.
Good point. And to get there, the debater suggested that data need to be available regarding who has been awarded land, as well as where and under what conditions the transactions were made. Like a legal trail of breadcrumbs so that the Hansels and Gretels of the world can actually keep track of things.
Breadcrumbs? I thought they were part of the candy story.
Didn't they get saved because they left a trail of breadcrumbs?
Did they get saved? I thought they got cooked in the.
Okay, before this gets totally dark, let's forget Hansel and Gretel. If smallholders are to have any part in LSLAs that promotes rural development in conjunction with urban development, there must be credible investment in smallholder farms and in the smallholder extension services, or the application of scientific knowledge to agricultural practices through farmer education. Unfortunately, though, the debaters were largely unsure of where funds could be obtained for this investment.
Along these lines, educational opportunities must be provided for farmers if they're expected to, you know, not abandon their land. Many who leave to migrate to urban areas are leaving in search of more education, so schooling needs to be provided in rural areas. This could perhaps be accomplished based on the expanded availability and access to information technology. So we're talking more brain pop and less Candy Crush here.
Okay, now that we're talking about cell phone apps, I think it's officially time to wrap things up here. So let's do a quick summary, shall we?
Good call. Get it? Like a cell phone?
Oh my God.
No.
You're not as
So
funny as you think you are.
I loved it.
Thanks, Daniela. Okay, so today we talked about quite a few things, really. Everything from plant breeding to farmer education to rural development, but also how these entities are intricately tied in the global land grab we're currently experiencing.
This isn't a side of food systems that we, meaning basically everyone, normally cover. So it's extra important that we don't let these issues slip between the cracks and become even more convoluted in the future.
So be sure to let us know any questions or comments you may have about today's episode by going to facebook.com/ISGBforum or by tweeting us at ISGBforum. To kickstart a discussion, maybe we could talk about how you think America-owned companies should be handling LSLAs in developing countries. Even if the United States isn't directly involved in these transactions, should we step up and police such purchases to ensure transparency? We look forward to hearing from you.
Thanks so much for socializing with science today, guys, and we'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.